Jackie Leiden here. You're listening to the podcast of Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. We're bringing you our favorite stories from Saturday's and Sunday's shows. This is our first podcast from the new headquarters. First up, big data. It sees you when you're sleeping. It knows when you're awake.
Put the health club membership on the credit card, but your visits to the liquor store should be in cash.
How did they come up with the dinosaur sounds for Jurassic Park, now even scarier in 3D?
It's funny how in sound, if you were to see the thing that made the scary element of that is the cutest little guy.
Yeah, that's what they say just before they start to munch you. Then something else scary, melting polar ice caps and what's beneath, oil, gas, and woolly mammoth ivory.
There are millions of tusks out in the tundra.
A weary atheist rejuvenates on a saint's path to the Pyrenees.
Boy, if you want a chance to connect with the great mystery, then walk for 2 or 3 months. And don't take your cell phone.
And finally, Nick Drake, the late British folkie, inspires a new CD. Today with a scene from Batman, The Dark Knight. In this scene, Batman stands in front of a row of blinking video monitors looking for the Joker.
You've turned every cell phone in Gotham into a microphone.
And a high-frequency generator receiver.
You took my sonar concept and applied it to every phone in the city. With half the city feeding you sonar, you can image all of Gotham. This is wrong.
Funny how film about technology that seemed so impossible just a few years ago seems ever more prescient. But in a world of big data, what you can track seems infinite. That's our cover story today, big data, the aggregation of our digital data trail. Who collects it, how they use it, and where we're going with it. Gary Marcus writes for the New Yorker's tech blog. He says collating big data is like gathering digital dust.
Big data, one way to think about it is it's a very valuable tool, but it's rarely the whole solution by itself.
Marcus tells us about Watson. That was the supercomputer IBM designed to compete on Jeopardy on TV a couple of years ago. Alex Trebek even introduced Watson.
Developed and programmed especially for this moment, making its first appearance on our national television program. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Watson.
Part of the way it did so well is they had a massive database, namely Wikipedia, built into it. And they were able to trawl that and also other aspects of the web in order to make good guesses.
Watson.
Who is Jude?
Yes. Watson.
Who is Michael Phelps?
Yes. Watson.
What is Event Horizon?
Yes.
Watson appeared to understand Trebek as he asked the questions. He competed against the two top Jeopardy champions, and Watson won. But big data doesn't function like a human brain.
There are also other things like classic artificial intelligence techniques, like temporal reasoning, trying to figure out, well, was this person alive before this other person?
Hmm.
Big data might get confused if you just used it by itself. It might say, well, these two things are very correlated, but it doesn't say, well, which one happened before which other one.
We've always had access to digital information, of course, ever since it was invented. But to understand how much there is now and how fast things are changing, we turn to Chris Barnett. He teaches computing at Nottingham University in England and runs a site called Explain. ExplainingComputers.com.
We've got more powerful processors, the cost of memory gets less, the cost of storage gets less, and also a lot more data is being created, everything from social media sites to people doing buying things online with e-commerce to simulations going on in companies and medical facilities. Everyone's creating more and more information.
And we're processing this data differently, using it almost narratively to make patterns and predictions.
Hospitals get lots and lots of information from their patients. And they don't just capture information on them in terms of who they are and their details, but they, for example, might put a camera inside someone during an operation and look at that data and probably just throw it away because they wouldn't see any value in that data after the operation. In a big data world, you'd say, well, if you can capture all the information from all the cameras put into every patient in the world in a year, you could look at all that data with a piece of artificial intelligence and start to predict things about the actual health of the population.
And the faster this goes, the more clients want it. Svetlana Sikular is a director at Gartner, a data research firm. She helps her business clients figure out what they can do with all that wealth of information.
Data is becoming pervasive. It's getting new qualities For example, we maps are the data, or text or voice or video, or geolocation of where you are. We can know everything about it.
Big data's not just what happens when marketing companies target their audience, you know, like those ads that pop up on a search engine. You search for one pair of shoes, you get shoe ads for weeks. It's also diagnostic. Like Chris Barnett in England, Svetlana Sikular sees big data making advances in medicine.
Medical records are being digitized by analyzing massive amounts of text records of those doctor's notes which were sitting somewhere in folders on the shelves. We can find out something which is really astonishing. We can find from doctor's notes that it's enough to look for some particular vein on the neck, and you will be able to predict that that's the best indicator of a disease.
Then there are the big data skeptics. Big data doesn't think. It evaluates, aggregates, and predicts. But reasoning, you could say there's a breakdown between cause and effect. Kate Crawford, a researcher for Microsoft and a visiting professor at MIT, gives an example from Boston. The city wanted data to fix its potholes, so it developed a smartphone app called Street Bump.
It passively collects GPS data and accelerometer data so that it can report when you drive over potholes.
Cool, right? Instead of having to actively seek out the potholes, the city could use people's phones to figure out when the car suddenly thumped over a rough spot. Except for one thing. The app only captured data in more affluent neighborhoods.
And indeed, this maps very closely around how rich a particular neighborhood is and what the ages of the people who live in that neighborhood.
Skewed data that collates only from better-off people might be missing a lot more than potholes. The ethics get tricky quickly. Boston's still working to fix both the app and the potholes. But Crawford warns that this kind of situation might happen more often as we look to big data for policy solutions. Steve Lohr has been writing about big data and privacy at the New York Times, where he's a reporter. Remember our Dark Knight example from Gotham? Or we could just as easily have turned to Orwell, because technology is allowing us to track movements around the web and the real world. Lohr isn't sure that all that Big Brother information needs to be tracked, or should be. He quotes Einstein.
Not everything that counts can be counted, and not everything that can be counted counts. And that's the tension here.
Not everything that can be counted counts. But the risk, it seems to me, is that there is a massive invasion of privacy risk. And this is something you've written a lot about.
Look, my concern, for instance, in tracking all your online behavior and aggregating it and making assumptions about you is not that these algorithms are so clever and they know everything. It's that they're so stupid. The real danger for most of us is discrimination by statistical inference.
Because it attributes a causality that might not be there.
Exactly. Right. And you know, if you're a simple person, maybe the algorithms sort of work. But if you have a complex set of motivations, you know, you search for deep fat fryers, right? And it may be because you're in a cooking school and that was an assignment. Or you're going to buy this for a friend, right? It correlates to unhealthy behavior. It's not just online. I think the place people really give up their privacy and don't realize it is putting everything on a credit card. That's the gold standard. It's got everything on you. And it's all being correlated and put together by these data brokers who track online behavior as well as, you know, your credit card transactions. And so, you know, what happens is your world will be shaped by what your transactions are. And so, you know, put the health club membership on the credit card, but your visits to the liquor store should be in cash. Because those things will follow you in ways you don't know now.
You write that the World Economic Forum issued a report last month that recommended ways in which privacy concerns could be addressed. And they drew from an example of the 1970 Fair Credit Reporting Law. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, this was the earlier round of privacy concerns related to computers. And this goes back to when the world started moving to mainframe computers. And so large corporations and government agencies had increasingly put personal information about your transactions. To some degree, they started putting IRS tax returns on computers. And that was a real wave of concern. And the Fair Credit Reporting Act was a limitation on what you could collect and how you could use it. It could be used, you know, somewhat for hiring and for loan evaluation. But other than that, you couldn't use it carte blanche. And the people who are in the privacy community these days kind of look back at that as, you know, small beer by comparison
to what's
now,
available
but
now.
People were much more sensitive to it back then. You know, these days, you kind of give up a little bit more and a little bit more, and there's advantages. There's advantages to using all these things. The Federal Trade Commission is investigating and has taken some actions, particularly on children and privacy, but also looking at these sort of data brokers in between. Mm-hmm. So those are the ones that facilitate the black box. And the real concern is that how the data is used, so that the things that you see in the world and the opportunities you're given will be determined by an algorithmic black box that you don't have any control over and may be wrong about you. And the way regulation is now looking at it, and the investigation that the Federal Trade Commission is doing is pushing for greater transparency. So, and this World Economic Forum report that talks about there should be an audit trail to your data in a way that there isn't now.
So if I'm an individual and I am leaving a data dust trail that is just so extensive, it's difficult to know where you would begin to try to rein some of that in a practical way. How do you protect yourself? Are there any kind of steps you'd take to limit what is known about your transactions?
You know, I'm a participant. I don't really have a good answer, Jackie. Be careful of your online behavior. I mean, it has consequences. It's the opposite of that old New Yorker cartoon where, you know, on the internet, nobody knows your dog.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They know you.
Steve Lohr, he writes about technology for the New York Times. If we're all just ashes to ashes and dust to dust, big data can keep track at a molecular level. Whether that's a comfort to you or a concern, knowledge is generally power. The question is, for whom? Last spring, the U.S. government invested over $200 million in big data. Years ago, nobody had much of a clue as to what dinosaurs sounded like. But in 1993, Summer's Block was busted by a movie that changed our imaginations forever.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Yeah, those dinosaurs had a pretty good theme song, too. Jurassic Park was a marvel of technology, and Gary Rydstrom was the sound designer for that movie. He won 2 Academy Awards for his work, and he joins us now from Lucasfilm in California. Gary, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let's start by talking about how you made these roars and squeals and hisses. Let's start by listening to the first dinosaur we hear, this huge Brachiosaurus. So is that an elephant trumpeting that I hear in there?
That probably is. A brachiosaurus is made up of elephants and cows and donkeys. Right after that, the brachiosaurus make a singing sound. It was made from a donkey. That was my favorite part of it, because a donkey has this, almost sounds like an animal yodeling, so it has this multiple pitch. And you slow that way down, it sounded like song.
So as a sound designer, where do you start reinventing the sound of the huge Brachiosaurus? What comes first?
Well, the first thing you do is you record sound. So we started collecting all sorts of weird animal sounds. And regular, I record my dog. I recorded horses. So we went to zoos. I tried to get every interesting animal recording we could find, not even caring right away what they would be for.
And you come back with your box of scary sounds.
You come back with a box of all sorts of sounds and more than you know what to do with, and then you try to sift through it in the studio and see what's interesting. And what's fun about recording is you're discovering things you didn't expect. One of my favorite memories was at the San Francisco Zoo, they asked if we wanted to record a koala bear, and I thought a koala bear would make a cute little squeak, but in reality, koala bears make this deep growl that we use for the T-Rex. I had no idea that koala bears sounded like that.
Let's just hear what that koala bear is capable of. This is the T-Rex, and this is one of the scariest parts of Jurassic Park. The two kids are hiding in the car at night in the rain, and T-Rex is getting hungry. I would have said tiger and trumpet more than koala bear.
Oh, that particular one doesn't have a koala bear, but the major roar of the T-Rex is a combination of a low-frequency sound, which is usually a tiger or an elephant. But the key element is the high-frequency scream element, which is a baby elephant that we recorded. And again, I didn't know what to expect, so I got this baby elephant. The big elephants we recorded weren't very interesting at that time, but the baby elephant came out and made this scream. And the baby elephant only did this once, and we kept trying to get it to do it again. And the handlers were saying, we never heard it do that before. That's a weird sound. So every time the T-Rex screams in the first Jurassic Park, that baby elephant is part of the major roar.
It is not going to spoil it for me. I want you to know.
It's funny how in sound, that, you know, if you were to see the thing that made the scary element of that is the cutest little guy, you know?
Well, that's what they initially thought about the little baby velociraptors, and we learned they got pretty hungry themselves. They were the fastest moving, I'd say, the most memorable of the dinosaurs. Let's hear the velociraptors. Ooh, that's sending chills down my spine right now. Now, I thought they were the most scary because they were so smart, and they have a lot of different kinds of sounds.
And they were made from a lot of different animals. I mean, there's a lot of, and even in that clip there, there's an African crane, a type of bird that made that hooting sound. There's a tortoise makes that bark sound that we use for the raptors talking to each other. And then there's some guttural sounds that a friend of mine made, my friend of mine named Dietrich Smith, who makes this very strange sound with his throat, and happened by my studio one day. And I said, well, you make any weird sounds? And he did that, and I used it in the movie.
How do you know when you've achieved perfection in terms of dinosaur sound?
Well, it has to affect me. I have to like it. But then, of course, Steven Spielberg has to really like it. Early on, especially with the T-Rex and the Raptor, I did some early tests and showed it to him. And I think I owe a lot of him buying off on the sounds to his son, Max, because his son, Max, was with him. And we had played the scene. It had T-Rex in it and a Raptor. And Max said, cool. And then I think once Max said cool, Steven went, this is great. Thank you. Keep moving forward.
Gary Rydstrom, you have worked on so many amazing movies, several Pixar titles, the new Star Wars series, Titanic, recently the Lincoln movie. I just am curious where Jurassic Park and the Lost World falls on your list of favorite gigs.
Jurassic Park was, well, for sound design, there's nothing better than Jurassic Park because it was like a toy store of... It scared me when I first saw it because there were so many different dinosaurs and it was Steven Spielberg and people would see it and it freaked me out thinking, oh my God, I'm going to have to do a good job. But there was no bigger candy store for sound design than Jurassic Park. So it's at the top of that list for me.
Wow. That's the Academy Award-winning sound designer, Gary Rydstrom, who joined us from the studios at Lucasfilm in California. Gary, thank you. I'm really scared now.
I'm sorry about that. Thank you.
The dancer who brought Firebird and the Nutcracker to life at the New York City Ballet died this week. Maria Tallchief was one of America's great prima ballerinas. NPR's Joel Rose has this remembrance.
Maria Tallchief soared to fame in 1949 when she danced the lead role in Stravinsky's Firebird in a production choreographed by George Balanchine.
He was a poet, and he taught us how to react and to become this poetry.
In an interview years later for the George Balanchine Trust, Tallchief talked about the moment the curtain fell.
The city center sounded like a stadium after a football game, after somebody's made a touchdown, screaming, yells of bravo, this and that, you know.
Tallchief was also married to Balanchine for several years during their long collaboration at the New York City Ballet. Before Maria Tallchief, it was routine for American dancers to change their names to make them sound Russian. Tallchief never did.
She was the first American ballet star.
Jordan Levin is the dance critic for the Miami Herald.
Firebird was New York City Ballet's first hit, and it was a hit largely because of Maria Tallchief. Everybody had to go see this amazing, gorgeous creature.
Maria Tallchief was born in Oklahoma. Her father was an Osage Indian whose family struck it rich in the oil business. She trained in Los Angeles but made her mark in New York. Allegra Kent was a younger ballerina who watched Tallchief dance at the New York City Ballet.
She was extraordinary. Her musicality, her musical phrasing, it was so subtle. Even a very simple step had an unusual quality to it.
Maria Talchief retired from the stage in the 1960s. She married prominent Chicago developer Henry Passion and led several ballet companies in Chicago through the 1970s and 80s.
She remembered every part that she danced to the minute detail.
Elise Passion is Talchief's daughter. She remembers watching her mother demonstrate Balanchine's techniques for younger generations of dancers.
You know, here she would be in her street clothes and her high heels, and she would embody the Balanchine technique and movement and grace. You could just feel the Firebird, you know, in her soul and in her spirit and in her body, even though she was probably in her 50s at that point.
Maria Talchief died Thursday in Chicago. She was 88 years old. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
Here is what's been happening year by year to the Columbia Glacier. It just retreats every single year.
Anyone who caught the film, An Inconvenient Truth, has seen this. The world's ice caps are melting. Most people are focused on what we're losing, but others have considered what might be gained by the disappearance of all that ice. First, let's look at what might lie beneath that ice.
The U.S. Geological Survey released a report in 2008 where they estimated that 13% of the world's remaining undiscovered oil and 30% of the remaining undiscovered natural gas could be in the Arctic.
That's reporter Amy Crawford. She wrote in this month's Smithsonian Magazine that Russia's already sent submarines deep into the Arctic Ocean looking for oil and natural gas, and China wants a piece of the action.
China obviously does not have any Arctic coastline. Their northern border is about 900 miles from the Arctic Circle, but they are seeking influence.
And that influence would come through Canada, one of their chief providers of oil. Next month, Canada will assume the chair of the Arctic Council, which you could consider the United Nations of the Arctic. So far, though, Russia has the upper hand.
Russia is hoping that the UN will recognize its claim to a very large swath of territory right up to the North Pole itself. So in 2007, they actually did this symbolic flag planting where they sent a formerly secret mini submarine down there.
On the ocean's bottom, they planted
a flag? Down to the ocean floor, and they planted a titanium flag. So it sounds like, you know, something out of Christopher Columbus's playbook.
And here's another boon that could result from the melting ice shelf, the Northwest Passage. For centuries, explorers tried desperately to navigate that route along North America's border with the Arctic, connecting the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. Again, reporter Amy Crawford.
The Northwest Passage became navigable for the first time in the summer of 2007. Navigable doesn't mean that it's totally free of ice. There's still icebergs. It's still fairly dangerous for an ordinary ship to pass through it.
But for China, the prospect of using the Northwest Passage for exports is becoming increasingly important.
It would be about 4,000 miles shorter than the route through the Panama Canal between the Atlantic and the Pacific, so that would clearly cut travel time by weeks.
And that means the question of who owns the Northwest Passage has once again come into play.
Canada says it's an internal waterway, but the U.S. says that this is an international route. So this dispute between the U.S. and Canada could become more heated as the route melts.
And we're not done with new enterprises appearing where ice once used to be. In Siberia, there are now mammoth tusk hunters. You heard me correctly. The tusks of long-dead woolly mammoths, encased in ice and permafrost for centuries, are now being revealed. And that means bounty hunters can legally take them. Photographer Evgenia Arbugaeva grew up in a small town in Siberia and heard about the rush of local men to sell mammoth ivory.
After international ban of elephant ivory trade in 1981, mammoth tusk became a sort of a substitute for this material. So I would say from 1981, people started to really see it as a business.
Arbugaeva and writer Brooke Larimer collaborated on a story for this month's edition of National Geographic magazine about the mammoth tusk boom. One picture shows a hunter half the size of an ancient tusk. The two traveled to remote Yakutia, Russia. Lerner spent a week just getting there from Beijing to a remote landscape.
There are millions of tusks out in the tundra. Many of them are buried very deep into the ice. Some of them are near the surface, which is what the local hunters are finding. 90% of mammoth tusks end up in China, where they are often turned into kind of mammoth trinkets and things, or these big pieces are carved by the master carvers in southern China and turned into objects of art that can be worth $1 or $1.5 million. And these hunters, as they go out, they're not coming back with loads and loads and loads of tusks in their boats. They can go a whole summer and find only a couple hundred pounds worth of tusks. But those tusks are so valuable. And the one that you see in the first shot, mm-hmm. is that amazing tusk that is arcing over more than twice the size of the tusk hunter underneath it. That is probably the finest specimen that was found last year. And that can be worth $80,000 to $100,000 or more, even at the point of sale up there in Yakutia.
And they're very fragile, right, the tusks? I mean, transporting them back has got to be difficult.
It depends on how long they've been exposed to the air. The hunters take very good care of not to expose them. But the ones that have been out on the beaches or that they find that have been exposed often disintegrate. And that's one of their arguments for why what they do is not exploitative, because they figure that they are actually rescuing some of these specimens that would otherwise just disintegrate and be lost forever.
How do scientists feel about the tusk hunters? Are they not perhaps disturbing scientific data by taking these tusks away?
Well, there are some scientists that really lament the trade having kind of soaked up all of these tusks. Each of these tusks is kind of like a tree which has rings. The tusks themselves can carry information about the climate, the diet, and that would be valuable data. On the other hand, if they find mammoth hair or actually an intact mammoth, they're the first ones to tell the scientists.
Yeah, I hadn't known until I read your story of these Asiatic peoples, the Yakut.
There are several different indigenous peoples that live in eastern Siberia. They originally went up kind of on these sleds across the ice, which is about a 30, 40-mile crossing to the first island. Well, the ice would then melt, and they were stranded on the islands looking for the tusks until the ice would freeze over in the fall and come back. Now most of them come back in September by boat, but these are small boats on very heavy seas. And what really brought the end of the mammoths was the warming climate. It reduced their grassland habitats. It flooded it over. Some of the seas rose significantly and stranded many of these populations until they eventually went extinct. And what's happening now is that as the climate also warms, you are finding these mammoth tusks starting to emerge. And the people that are there are following the same pathways, enduring the same brutal conditions, and they're pursuing the same beast, basically, as their forebears 10,000 years ago. It's an extraordinarily difficult life, and it's probably one of the toughest occupations in the world.
That's writer Brooke Lerner. Together, he and photographer Evgenia Arbugaeva produced the article of Mammoths and Men for the April issue of National Geographic magazine. For centuries, pilgrims have made their way along the El Camino de Santiago de Compostela, or the Way. It's an ancient route honoring St. James and can take a traveler on foot across Western Europe to Spain. Travel writer David Downey and his wife Allison decided to begin in Paris, their longtime home. Downey stresses he wasn't looking for God, maybe just enlightenment. He's written a book about it, an entertaining read that takes us through the Burgundy wine country, the southern territory called the Morvan, and into countless medieval auberges, or little inns. David Downey, welcome to the program.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
You're such good company. Your book is called Paris to the Pyrenees, A Skeptic Pilgrim Walks the Way of St. James. Now, your whole walk is layered with history, but you are not taking this as a pilgrim. People come from all over Europe to get to Spain, where St. James relics are said to be. You are doing it for a very, very different reason. First of all, you're a pretty secular fellow. So why did you decide to do this?
Well, you talked about enlightenment, and I would say that that applies in two ways. I was hugely overweight, and I wanted to lighten my carcass because I could barely walk at one point. And, you know, I was breaking away and unplugging and seeking silence and trying to answer some of the big questions that you usually ask yourself when you're an adolescent. And I suppose I had, but I guess you could call it a kind of midlife crisis. But there were other reasons. I mean, I really wanted to walk across France in order to, in a way, possess it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can look at a country through your car windshield or from a train or an airplane, but when you walk across it, it somehow belongs to you.
It sounds wonderful. You are a fabulous company, and it's muddy, and it's wild, and it's hard, and you guys are staying off the main roads. You're seeing giant beech trees, picturesque villages, chapels that maybe are lucky to have one person left in them. Let's begin where you begin. It's a place called Vézelay, and some of the bones of Mary Magdalene are said to be in the crypt there.
I think the key word there is said to be there, but whether they're there or not, it doesn't really matter. If people think that those are her relics, that's what's important. It was a very important jumping-off point for pilgrimages to Santiago, starting way, way back, about 1,000 years ago. And it kind of lived its heyday until the late 1200s, when the Vatican decided to de-authenticate the bones, which was very bad news for Vézelay. But anyway, it's made a big comeback. It's beautifully restored. So every year, hundreds or thousands of pilgrims gather there and go tramping down the main route. What we did is we took an even older route that leads from Vézelay across the Morvan, which you mentioned, which is this mountainous area in northern central Burgundy. And then we made our way through wine country down to Cluny. In about a month of walking, I think we saw a total of maybe six people and maybe two pilgrims. It was magical.
Although when you did meet a pilgrim, had he walked all the way from Switzerland?
Yes, he had not only walked from Switzerland, he walked all the way to Santiago, and then he walked to Jerusalem. And we were seeing him on the way back from Jerusalem via Santiago again. And how he got from Santiago to Jerusalem, I don't know. He didn't tell us, but he had walked something incredible, like, I don't know, 5,000 miles.
Oh, my goodness. What other kinds of people did you encounter in the region of Burgundy? You said it really was the changing face of France once you got there.
People don't realize it, but there are lots of rural areas of France that are largely abandoned. They're empty most of the year. In summer, they fill up with Parisians on vacation. But we walked through there in April and May. It felt like we were, I don't know, up in the Appalachians. I mean, run-down farms with people who looked like they hadn't seen a razor or a bathtub in a long time. Most of them ran away from us. I don't blame them. I mean, I'm kind of scary looking. I wear these big dark glasses and a hat because I can't stand the sun. Occasionally, we were able to catch up with them and get them to give us some water because there was no drinking water. The other group of people we met were Parisians, most of them middle-aged or older, who had decided to reinvent themselves in the countryside. This group of people is known here in France as the neo-ruraux, as in neo-rural people. And we met a bunch of these Parisians who were bringing life back to these largely abandoned villages. And thank God we met them, because they're the only ones who gave us food and water.
It was a hard trip. I mean, you and your wife, you're not in your 20s. You've had health problems. You've got a backpack on as you're going up and downhill, trying to stay off any kind of bigger road and just go on these footpaths. What did you find? If it wasn't spirituality, what would you say a pilgrimage really embodies?
I think it depends on who you are and what you're looking for and what you allow to happen. I talked to a monk in a monastery, an incredible monastery called Conques, and I asked him, you see tens of thousands of people coming through here. Is there one thing that unites us all, that we all have in common, whether we're atheists or believers? And he said, yes, actually there is. Everyone who does this pilgrimage or any pilgrimage is driven by an irresistible urge to do it, and they don't know where it comes from. And sometimes they figure it out while they're walking or afterwards or never. And, you know, the more I thought about it, the more I realized he was right. I set out with a zillion questions in my head, and I didn't come back with a lot of answers. I came back with more questions. But I really do think that the question is the answer. It's the same thing. And we get question from quest. It's all going out and searching. And I think, you know, fundamentally, that's what we have to do. For me, it's all about curiosity and wonder and mystery. And boy, if you want a chance to connect with the great mystery, then walk for 2 or 3 months. And don't take your cell phone.
That's David Downey. He's the author of a new book, Paris to the Pyrenees, A Skeptic Pilgrim Walks the Way of St. James. Merci beaucoup.
Merci à vous.
So it written and so it say. Bingo moon is on his way.
His voice was enchanting and ethereal. Yet English folk musician Nick Drake dealt with depression and other psychiatric problems until his death from an overdose in 1974. He was just 26. Decades later, Pink Moon, this song, would find a wide audience thanks to a Volkswagen ad back in 1999. It sparked a revival in Drake's entire body of work, music overlooked in his day, now inspiring legions of musicians. This is Teddy Thompson, the son of Richard and Linda Thompson, in duet with newcomer Crystal Warren. And this song was recorded live at one of a series of tribute concerts, a dozen or so musicians all playing the music of Nick Drake. Those concerts were produced by the veteran music producer, Joe Boyd, who also produced Nick Drake's first two albums back in 1969 and 1970 in England. And yet, says Joe, even he was surprised by the Volkswagen ad.
After this ad had such an impact and really multiplied the sales, annual sales of Nick Drake Records, I met the team, the creative team who put the ad together, and they were a bunch of kind of slackers from an alternative Boston ad agency. And this guy told me that they'd built the whole storyboard for the ad around a track by The Church. Under the Milky Way tonight. And the night before the presentation to Volkswagen, he was sitting at home smoking something and listening to Pink Moon. And he suddenly had this blinding insight that this was the track, not the Church track. And he came in the next morning and played it to the rest of the team. And he said, let's go with this. And at the very last minute, sort of minutes before the Volkswagen ad execs arrived, they switched the whole ad, and that's why so many people know Nick Drake today.
So he written and so he say, Bingo Moon is on his way. None of you stand so tall. Bingo Moon.
Let's come back to this album that you've just produced, Way to Blue, the songs of Nick Drake. You said that you were looking for people who were really comfortable doing this music, who really gave it new dimensions for you. A lot of women perform Nick Drake songs, which I have to say I found really wonderful. Vashti Bunyan, for example.
Which will you go for? Which will you
Well, Vashti is a fascinating character because her story is so similar to Nick's. You know, she was a very delicate, shy, soft-voiced singer who I heard actually before Nick in the 60s, in 1966, and eventually made a record with her in 1970, which didn't sell, sold even less than Nick's. But at one point, I introduced them to each other and tried to get them to write a song together. And it was a complete flop because they were both so shy that neither of them said a word, I think, in the entire time they spent in a room together. And, of course, her story is that she had a record that didn't sell. She was living in a caravan in the Outer Hebrides, had children, moved to Edinburgh, remarried, never told anyone that she'd had a career, was so crushed by the failure of the career, very much like Nick. But then the internet came along, and she discovered there was this huge following for her one album, and the sort of 200 copies that it had sold had been copied on tape and circulated around the world. And eventually it was reissued, and she's had this whole new career and a whole new following of people. And so it just seemed perfect to have her as part of it.
Which will you hope for? Which can it be? Which will you take? No, if you won't take me.
Joe, I don't want to press, because this is just a beautiful tribute album, but you can't help but think about it, relive your experiences, especially as you were there and spending so much time with the young Nick Drake. Were you concerned about his emotional welfare? Did he seem like someone who might not make it physically to you?
I think there are two answers to that question. One is, in 1971, well, at the end of 1970, I was kind of burned out, and I sold my company to Island Records. And at that time, I was depressed about the state of Nick's career. I felt there was an unfinished task, but I didn't really know what to do. I was frustrated with Nick because of his inability to talk when he was on stage, and I didn't really know where to go, but I also knew that I needed to stop doing what I was doing. And obviously, I look back and I have many, many second guessings of that decision. Then, 3 months after I had moved to California, I got a phone call from Molly, from his mother, and she said, "We want Nick to go to a psychiatrist." And Nick doesn't want to go because he thinks it's kind of shameful, which was a typical attitude in Britain at that time. And she wanted me to call him and tell him that I wouldn't think any the less of him. And I called him, and he ended up going to an analyst who gave him antidepressants. And of course, antidepressants in those days were way more stronger than they are today. And when I met him on a return visit to Britain a year later, he was in terrible shape. And I really was shocked and alarmed by his physical appearance, by his psychological deterioration. And so we went back in the studio. You know, I thought this was the best therapy for him, would be to start making music again in the studio. And it was painful to watch him because he struggled to play the guitar. He struggled to sing as he played the guitar. And this was a man who never made a mistake in the studio on the first records. You could just shut off his monitor and listen to everybody else because Nick would always be perfect. He was technically one of the greatest musicians I've ever worked with.
Wow. You've worked with Pink Floyd, REM, Fairport Convention, Kate and Adam McGarrigle, 10,000 Maniacs, and the list really goes on. You've been so iconic and influential. And it just seems that Nick Drake really has held a very different and special kind of place in your memory. And there are so many reasons why.
Yeah, I mean, partly it's the frustration of somebody who I thought deserved to be heard around the world and who now has been heard around the world, dying without knowing that, knowing how much people loved his music. But also, I think the music itself, I can still, I think more almost than any other record that I've ever been involved with, I could put on Brighter Later or Five Leaves Left and listen to them just for pleasure, because the songs are so rich and so distinctive, You know, it was a pleasure working in the studio. And, you know, one of the greatest pleasures I ever had as a producer.
That's Joe Boyd. He produced a series of concerts to pay tribute to the music of Nick Drake, and those recordings resulted in a new album. It's called Way to Blue, The Songs of Nick Drake, and you can listen to a few tracks on our website, nprmusic.org. Joe Boyd, it really has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
I could have been your pillow, I could have been your dog. I could have stayed beside you, could have stayed for more. I could have been your statue, could have been your friend. A whole long lifetime could have been the end.
Folks, that's it for our podcast this week. The people who put this show together are Phil Harrell, Liz Baker, Amy Held, Lily Percy, Becky Sullivan, and Acacia Squires. Our interns are Annie Russell and Rachel Rude. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Mathoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Jackie Lydon. Don't worry, we'll be back next week with more of the best stories from weekends on All Things Considered. And you can catch us on Saturdays and Sundays on your local public radio station or meet us right back here on the podcast. Until then, take care.
One of these things first. Could have been a whistle, could have been a flute. A real life giver, could have been a boat. I could have been a signpost, could have been a clock. As simple as a kettle, steady as a rock. Could be even here. I would be, I should be so near.